readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who is very happy to mark the vernal equinox. It's springtime at last. Phew! We've come through a winter of brutal storms and many challenges. But avanti! It's time to look forward. I've done the research, consulted the bestseller lists, and found reader favorites. Today, we'll be introduced to characters who've come through adversity to the other side. After their winter of discontent, they are reinvigorated, armed with a fresh perspective. Perhaps we can find some inspiration from their renewal. This week is all about fresh starts, as we turn to page one of the book report. Anna Quinlan's Still Life with Breadcrumbs is a moving and often funny tale of unexpected love. Rebecca Winter is a photographer whose early work made her both an unlikely heroine for many women and incredibly successful. But today, her photographs are no longer the talk of the town, and her bank balance is so shaky, she's forced to trade the city and her beloved apartment for a ramshackle cabin in the woods. In her new small town, Rebecca discovers a roofer named Jim Bates. He shows her that what she sees through a camera lens is not all there is to life. Carrington McDuffie narrates.
She tried to look at her watch, but it was a small, flat gold watch, like a superannuated dime, that her parents had given her when she married, as though her marriage was a retirement of some kind. It had the initials RWS on the back, what her mother called her new monogram, although Rebecca had never changed her name. Still, she had great sentimental attachment to the watch, mainly because of her father, who had selected it and had taken an enormous amount of pleasure in giving it to her.
"That's a beauty," he said when she removed it from the mahogany box.
"It's not waterproof," her mother added. Under the best of conditions, it was a difficult watch to read, never mind now, in a bedroom fringed with large pine trees and with the heavy cloud cover of a muggy May night, a thunderstorm moving in overhead. The room was so dark you could not see your hand in front of you. To test this, Rebecca held her hand in front of her, where it glimmered whitely, faintly. She could see it, but just barely. She was not sleeping soundly in the strange bed, which had a well in the center into which she fell whenever she rolled over, a well like the one used for drainage along the side of the road. Rebecca still didn't know the name of the road the cottage was on. It was the second right off 547, that's all she knew. Then the driveway past the pump house. What did the pump house pump? She had said it aloud as she turned in. No answer. Who lives in a house on a road whose name she does not know? Who moves into a place she has seen only in flattering photographs on the internet? It reminded her of what she had heard a woman telling a friend at the next table when she was waiting to have lunch with an art book editor. You walk in and you can't pick them out at the bar because they look nothing like their picture on the website, the woman had said. Nothing, not a thing. The cottage was the real estate version of online dating, built atop lies, leading downhill to disenchantment, or capitulation. "We were so happy here," the owner had said in an email, attaching a photo of two men with their arms around one another in front of a large tree. They were so happy here, and then they left and took all the comfortable furniture with them and replaced it with bits and pieces from the Salvation Army. A true child of New York, Rebecca thought she felt the bites of bedbugs. She rolled over and fell into the well in the mattress, the gunshot just a memory, perhaps only an illusion. It was quiet now. There was a smell. There were so many smells. Mildew, damp linen, trampled plants, the bananas in the glass bowl on the drain board, a whiff of what might be skunk or skunk cabbage. In the backyard, she had taken a deep breath. It had smelled as though the entire forest around her was rotting by inches. She sniffed audibly, or it would have been audible if there had been anyone to hear. Rebecca was entirely alone. She told herself that she was surprised she wasn't more frightened by the sound of the gunshot. In truth, she was terrified,
but her body acknowledged the fear without her mind's concurrence, the way she had developed a bad back after her divorce when she was absolutely sure she was getting along fine. Instead of pajamas, she was wearing an old T-shirt that commemorated an exhibition of daguerreotypes at the New York Historical Society, and a pair of very old cotton panties. Her legs were like walking sticks beneath the wool blanket, stiff and tense. The quiet of the country was unnerving. She didn't find it peaceful in the least, more like the TV with the mute button pressed on the remote. Empty. Her cell phone would not work in the house. Neither would her computer. She had made a terrible mistake. That was her conclusion even before the nominal gunshot, and then the noise overhead that followed.
We've just heard Still Life with Breadcrumbs by Anna Quindlen. Wally Lamb is the incredibly popular author of She's Come Undone and I Know This Much Is True, both of which were selected for Oprah's Book Club. Wally has been the director of the Writing Center at Connecticut's Norwich Free Academy and has taught creative writing in the English department at the University of Connecticut. Lamb was born in Norwich, Connecticut. Interestingly, he credits his ability to write in female as well as male voices with having grown up with older sisters in a neighborhood largely populated by girls. He studied at the University of Connecticut, earning a BA and an MA in education and an MFA in writing from Vermont College. He began writing in 1981, the year he became a first-time father. Short stories were first, then his first novel, She's Come Undone, followed 6 years later by I Know This Much Is True. In his new title, We Are Water, Lamb returns to his familiar setting of Three Rivers. Let's speak with him about it now. Welcome, Wally. It's a thrill to have you with us on the Book Report.
Yeah, thanks, Elaine. I'm happy to be here with you.
What are we to make of the fact that the book opens with a conversation between a Mr. Agnello, a museum director, and a journalist, keeping in mind that the Italian word Agnello translates into lamb?
You found that out, huh?
I did.
Well, of course, I'm doing this a little tongue-in-cheek, because Gualtiero means Walter, and Agnello means lamb. And so it's a sort of a Hitchcockian thing that I'm doing here.
If you would introduce us to Annie O.
Yeah. Annie is she's a complicated and complex individual. Had a very rough childhood. Her mother died in a flood. Her father, as a result, drank himself to death. And because she was left alone in the clutches of an older cousin, he began to molest her, and so she had that in her past as well. And so she grows up pretty much an orphan and marries a guy who is a psychologist. They're something of a mismatch, but their marriage lasts for about 27 years. They have three children who are in their 20s when the novel begins. Annie has become what I would call an outsider artist. She's not a trained artist, but she, for reasons that she doesn't even understand, begins to create this angry art that, from found objects, you know, things left on the sidewalk or things in landfills or, clearance sales, that kind of thing. And she becomes quite commercially successful and falls in love with her gallerist, the woman who makes her commercially successful, and decides to leave her husband, Orion, for Vivica.
Okay. Orion seems to be a caring husband, a good provider, and a loving father. Do you believe he failed the family?
Well, in some ways, yes. I believe he is a benign enough person, but he's also guilty of being asleep at the wheel. He is a workaholic, goes to the university where he counsels students early in the morning, comes home late, is a little bit self-pitying, I would say. And what is going on domestically is sort of flies past him. And what I mean by that is particularly the abuse of Annie, or by Annie, of one of their three children. Their kids are two twins, fraternal twins, male and female, and then they have a younger daughter as well. And Annie, based on some of the things that had happened to her when she was a kid, begins to target for physical violence, physical abuse, her son, her male child.
You mentioned Vivica. I'm not quite sure if we're supposed to like her. She is Annie's partner.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I wasn't quite sure either. The jury was out on Vivica for quite a while I was writing. You know, Elaine, I'm not the kind of writer who sort of maps everything out or outlines everything and writes toward a preconceived ending. I show up at the word processor every day to find out what's going to happen next. And so I was getting, of course, different information as I was speaking in the voice of Orion than I was speaking in the voice of Annie about who this Vivica is. Now, there are a lot of voices in the story. It's told from multiple characters in the first person, but I was pretty sure I did not want Vivica to speak. I didn't want her to be one of those characters, because I was still weighing the evidence about who she was, and so I wanted to understand her through various points of view.
You mentioned the outsider artist Josephus. He either fell or was pushed into a well after a painting of a local white girl was his version of Adam and Eve.
I can tell you that Josephus Jones is based on an actual person, an outsider artist who was African American, as is Jones, who grew up in my hometown of Norwich, Connecticut. And he was a laborer, but he began to paint obsessively, because he couldn't not paint. And I've seen many of his paintings. He couldn't sell any of them in his own lifetime, but now he's highly collectible, as sometimes happens. And he had a white wife. He was a black man in 1940s, 1950s Eastern Connecticut, and he became a target. Now, officially, the record says that his death was accidental. But the black community in Norwich believed at the time, and still believes, that he was targeted for a racial killing.
Was there actually a faction of the KKK operating in Connecticut at that time?
Yes, and further, further along as well. I remember in Eastern Connecticut, in the town of Scotland, Connecticut, which is not too far from the University of Connecticut, there was a local chapter of the KKK operating. It was very much under the radar, but it was still there.
You never think that it. You know, you think of the KKK as so southern. It's very surprising to learn that they were operating in the Northeast as well.
Yeah, I think the Northeast gets a free pass in a lot of ways about the whole racial component of this country, and the disgraceful legacy of slavery and anti-black sentiment. But yeah, it did exist.
Annie keeps a terrible secret from her family, which you've already alluded to, because she believes she's protecting them. But her secret impacts her life and her children's life, as you've said, and it's the source of her deep-rooted anger. Talk about her decision to keep such a devastating secret.
Well, you know, Elaine, I think when I look back at this novel, I wasn't so much aware of it at the time, but, I'm living in the world of the story, but I also live in the real world. And one of the things that I do in the real world is I volunteer at a women's prison in Connecticut. I teach creative writing there. Now, my students at this prison can write about, in any genre that they want. They can elect to write poetry or drama or short story or memoir. Most of them choose memoir pieces because they have arrived at a time in their lives and a place in their lives that they never planned on being at. And so when they write these autobiographical pieces, many times, you know, once they begin to trust me, and once, more importantly, once they begin to trust one another and themselves, they begin to write some very deeply personal, very deeply disturbing stories about childhood experiences. And sadly, there is a high correlation between incest victimhood and later incarceration. I think it's probably higher for females than males, but it certainly is the case for males as well. And I've been doing this program for about 14 years, and so little by little, through their writing, they have educated me about what goes on in houses like this, and how secrets are kept, and with lots of times with threats and so forth. And so I think in our culture, women tend to keep things in, and men tend to be more explosive. And so if I'm a guy and I'm mad at the guy who, might have, sexually abused me when I was a kid, I can go to the bar and punch out the guy on the next stool. But women, I think, are more apt to sort of hold it in until they snap. And so that was kind of the scenario that I created for Annie.
So is the idea for your next novel already bubbling around?
I have committed to a next novel, which is going to be sort of like my little comic novella that I published a couple of years ago, a little Christmas story called Wishin' and Hopin'. And because this is the book that I've finished now, We Are Water, has some dark themes, and it's very serious in its content. I kind of wanted to remind myself that you can walk on the, on the sunny side of the street as well.
Well, Wally, I want to thank you so much for stopping by. I love the book, and I would encourage everyone to go out and read it. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Elaine. This was fun talking to you, and I wish you all the best.
Thanks.
And now let's listen to a sampling of We Are Water, performed by an ensemble cast.
I first laid eyes on Joe in the spring of 1957, when he appeared at the opening of an exhibition I had mounted called 19th Century Maritime New England. It was a pretentious title for a self-congratulatory concept, a show that had been commissioned by a wealthy Three Rivers collector of maritime art, whose grandfather had made millions in oceanic shipping. He had compensated the museum quite generously for my curatorial work, but it had bored me to tears to hang that show. All those paintings of frigates, brigs, and steamships at sea. All that glorification of war and money. On the afternoon of the opening, I was making small talk with Marietta Colson, president of the Friends of the Statler, when she stopped mid-conversation and looked over my shoulder. A frown came over her face. "Well, well, what have we here?" she said. "Trouble?" My eyes followed hers to the far end of the gallery, and there was Jones. Among the well-heeled, silver-haired patrons who had come to the opening, he was an anomaly, with his mahogany skin and flattened nose, his powerful laborer's build, and laborer's overalls. We watched him, Marietta and I, as he wandered from painting to painting. He was carrying a large cardboard box in front of him, and perhaps that was why he reminded me of the gift-bearing Abyssinian king immortalized in The Adoration of the Magi. Not the famous Gentile de Fabriano painting, but the later one by Albrecht Dürer, who, to splendid effect, had incorporated the classicism of the Italian Renaissance in his Northern European art. Do you know that work?
I know Dürer, but not that painting specifically. But go on.
Well, throughout the gallery, conversations stopped and heads turned toward Josephus. "I hope there's nothing menacing in that box he's holding," Marietta said. "Do you think we should notify the police?" I shook my head and walked toward him. He was standing before a large Calkins oil of La Amistad, the schooner that had transported African slaves to Cuba. The painting depicted the slaves' revolt against their captors. "Welcome," I said. "You have a good eye. This is the best painting in the show." He told me he liked pictures that told a story. Ah, yes, narrative paintings, I said. I'm drawn to them, too. His bushy hair and eyebrows were gray with cement dust, and the bib of his overalls was streaked with dirt and stained with paint. He had trouble making eye contact. Why had he come? I paint pictures, too, he said. I can't help it. I knew what he meant, of course. Had I not been painting for decades, more involuntarily than voluntarily at times? I'm Gualtiero Agnello, the director of this museum, I said, holding out my hand. And you are? He told me his name, placed his box on the floor and shook my hand. His was twice the size of mine, and as rough as sandpaper. You the one they told me to come and see, he said. He didn't identify who they were, and I didn't ask. He picked up his box and held it at arm's length, expecting me to take it. These are some of my pictures. You want to look at them? I told him this wasn't really a convenient time. Could he come back someday the following week? He shook his head. He worked, he said. He could leave them here. I was hesitant, suspecting that he had no more talent than the Sunday painters who often contacted me, dowagers and dilettantes for the most part, who became huffy when I failed to validate their assumptions of artistic genius. I didn't want to be the bearer of bad news. Still, I could tell that it had cost him something to come here. And I didn't want to disappoint him either. Tell you what, I said. You see that table over there where the punch bowl is? Slide your box underneath it. I'll look at your work when I have a chance and get back to you. Do you have a telephone? He shook his head. But you can call my boss when you're ready to talk, and he can tell me. I don't know his number, but he's in the phone book. Mr. Angus Skloot.
We've just heard We Are Water by Wally Lam. Matthew Quick, the author of The Silver Linings Playbook, is just out with The Good Luck of Right Now. For 38 years, Bartholomew Neal has lived with his mother. When she dies, Bartholomew has no idea how to be on his own. His grief counselor says he needs to find his flock and leave the nest. But how does a man whose whole life has been grounded in Mom, Saturday Mass, and the library learn to fly? Bartholomew thinks he's found a clue when he discovers a free Tibet letter from Richard Gere hidden in his mother's underwear drawer. In her final days, Mom called him Richard. There must be some cosmic connection. Believing the author is meant to help him, Bartholomew awkwardly starts his new life by writing Richard Gere a series of letters exploring Jung and the Dalai Lama, philosophy and faith, alien abduction, and cat telepathy. But mostly, the letters reveal one man's heartbreakingly earnest attempt to assemble a family of his own. Oliver Wyman narrates.
As you might have gathered, Mom wasn't all there during the last few years of her life. And by the very end, extreme dementia had set in, which made it hard to distinguish the pretending of her final days from the real world. Everything blurred over time. During her good moments, if you can believe it, she actually used to think, pretend, that I was you, that Richard Gere was living with her, taking care of her, which must have been a welcome alternative to the truth that her ordinary, unaccomplished son was her primary caregiver. "What will we be having for dinner tonight, Richard?" she'd say. "Such a pleasure to finally spend so much time with you, Richard." It was like when I was a boy, and we pretend we were eating dinner with a famous guest. Ronald Reagan, St. Francis, Mickey Mouse, Ed McMahon, Mary Lou Retton, occupying one of the two seats in the kitchen that were always empty, except when Father McNamee visited. As I previously stated, Mom was quite a fan of yours. You probably visited our kitchen table before, but to be honest, I don't remember a specific Richard Gere visit from childhood. Regardless, I indulged her and played my role. So you were manifested through me, even though I'm not as handsome and therefore made a poor stand-in. I hope you don't mind my having invoked you without your permission. It was a simple thing that gave Mom great pleasure. Her face lit up like the Wanamaker's Christmas light show every time you came to visit. And after the failed chemo and brain surgery, and the awful, sick, retching aftermath, it was hard to get her to smile or be happy about anything, which is why I went along with the game of you and me becoming we. It started one night after we watched our well-worn VCR copy of Pretty Woman, one of Mom's favorite movies. As the end credits rolled, she patted my arm and said, "I'm going to bed now, Richard." I looked at her, and she smiled almost mischievously, like I'd seen the sexy fast girls do with their shiny painted lips back when I was in high school. That salacious smile made me feel nauseated, because I knew it meant trouble. It was so unlike Mom, too. It was the beginning of living with a stranger. I said, "Why did you call me Richard?" She laid her hand gently on my thigh, and in this very flirtatious, girlish voice, while batting her eyelids, she said, "Because that's your name, silly." During the 38 years we had known each other, Mom had never once before called me silly. The tiny, angry man in my stomach pounded my liver with his fists. I knew we were in trouble. "Mom, it's me, Bartholomew, your only son." When I looked into her eyes, she didn't seem to see me. It was like she was having a vision, seeing what I could not. It made me wonder if Mom had used some sort of womanly witchcraft and turned me into you somehow. That we, you and me, had become one in her mind. Richard Gere, Bartholomew Neal, we. Mom took her hand off my thigh and said, "You're a handsome man, Richard, the love of my life even. But I'm not going to make the same mistake twice. You made your choice, so you'll just have to sleep on the couch. See you in the morning." Then she floated up the stairs, moving quicker than she had in months. She looked ecstatic, like the haloed saints depicted in stained glass at St. Gabriel's. Mom seemed to be guided by divinity. Her madness appeared holy. She was bathed in light. As uncomfortable as that exchange was, I liked seeing Mom lit up, happy. And pretending has always been easy for me. I have pretended my entire life. Plus, there was the game from my childhood, so I had certainly practiced.
That was The Good Luck of Right Now by Matthew Quick. Perfect is the new novel from Rachel Joyce, popular author of The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. In this tale, 11-year-old Byron Hemmings wakes to a morning that looks like any other. His school uniform is draped over his wooden desk chair. His sister and mom argue in the kitchen over breakfast. But when the three of them leave home, driving into a dense summer fog, the morning takes a terrible turn. Over the days and weeks that follow, Byron's perfect world is shattered. Unable to trust his parents, he confides in his best friend James, and together they concoct a plan. Rachel Joyce's bewitching characters find their ordinary lives thrown into chaos. They discover that in confronting hard truths about their pasts, they will forge unexpected relationships with profound and surprising impact. Paul Rees narrates.
It was the beginning of June in 1972. A trim morning light slid beneath Byron's blue curtains and picked out his neatly ordered possessions. There were his Look and Learn annuals, his stamp album, his torch, his new abracadabra magic box, and the chemistry set with its own magnifying glass that he had received for Christmas. His school uniform had been washed and pressed by his mother the night before, and was arranged in a flattened boy shape on a chair. Byron checked both his watch and his alarm clock. The second hands were moving steadily. Crossing the hall in silence, he eased open the door of his mother's room and took up his place on the edge of her bed. She lay very still. Her hair was a gold frill on the pillow, and her face trembled with each breath as if she were made of water. Through her skin he could see the purple of her veins. Byron's hands were soft and plump like the flesh of a peach, but James already had veins, faint threads that ran from his knuckles and would one day become ridges like a man's. At 6:30, the alarm clock rang into the silence and his mother's eyes flashed open, a shimmer of blue. "Hello, sweetheart." "I'm worried," said Byron. "It isn't time again." She reached for her glass and her pill and took a sip of water. "Suppose they're going to add the extra seconds today. Is James worried too? Oh, he seems to have forgotten." She wiped her mouth and he saw she was smiling. Two dimples had appeared like tiny punctures in her cheeks. "We've been through this. We keep doing it. When they add the seconds, they'll say something about it first in the Times. They'll talk about it on Nationwide." "It's giving me a headache," he said. "When it happens, you won't notice. 2 seconds and nothing." Byron felt his blood heat. He almost stood, but sat back again. "That's what nobody realizes. 2 seconds are huge. It's the difference between something happening and something not happening. You could take one step too many and fall over the edge of a cliff. It's very dangerous." The words came out in a rush. She gazed back at him with her face crumpled in the way she did when she was trying to work out a sum. "We really must get up," she said. His mother pulled back the curtains at the bay window and stared out. A summer mist was pouring in from Cranham Moor, so thick that the hills beyond the garden looked in danger of being washed away. She glanced at her wrist. 7:24, she said, as if she were informing her watch of the correct time. Lifting her pink dressing gown from its hook, she went to wake Lucy. When Byron pictured the inside of his mother's head, he imagined a series of tiny inlaid drawers with jewelled handles so delicate his fingers would struggle to get a grip. The other mothers were not like her. They wore crochet tank tops and layered skirts, and some of them even had the new wedge shoes. Byron's father preferred his wife to dress more formally. With her slim skirts and pointy heels, her matching handbag and her notebook, Diana made other women look both oversized and underprepared. Andrea Lowe, who was James's mother, towered over her like a dark-haired giant. Diana's notebook contained articles she had snipped and glued from the pages of Good Housekeeping and Family Circle. She wrote down birthdays she had to remember, important dates for the school term, as well as recipes, needlecraft instructions, planting ideas, hairstyling tips, and words she had not heard before. Her notebook bulged with suggestions for improvement. 22 new hairdos to make you even prettier this summer. Tissue paper gifts for every occasion. Cooking with offal. I before E except after C. "Elle est la plus belle mère," James sometimes said. And when he did, he blushed and fell silent, as if in contemplation of something sacred.
That was Perfect by Rachel Joyce. Madame et Monsieur, may I introduce Catherine Pencol, one of France's most popular authors. Luckily for American audiences, her Yellow Eyes of Crocodiles has recently been translated so that we too may enjoy her hilarious bestseller. When her chronically unemployed husband runs off to start a crocodile farm in Kenya with his mistress, Josephine is left in an unhappy state of affairs. The mother of two, Josephine is forced to maintain a stable family life while making ends meet on her meager salary as a medieval history scholar. Meanwhile, Josephine's charismatic sister, Iris, seems to have it all. A wealthy husband, gorgeous looks, and a très chic Paris apartment, but even Iris dreams of bringing meaning back into her life. When Iris charms a famous publisher into offering her a lucrative deal for a 12th century romance, she offers her sister a deal of her own. Josephine will write the novel and pocket all the proceeds, but the book will be published under Iris's name. All is well, that is, until the book becomes the literary sensation of the season. Ellen Archer narrates.
Antoine followed the exact same routine every day. Up with the kids at 7, breakfast of whole wheat toast, apricot jam with salted butter, and freshly squeezed orange juice. Next came a 30-minute workout. Back, stomach, abs, quads. Then the newspapers, which his daughters took turns bringing him before they left for school. This was followed by a careful perusal of the Help Wanted ads and mailing his resume when he saw something interesting. Then a shower and shave, selecting his clothes for the day, and finally, a game of chess. Choosing what to wear was his morning's most challenging moment. He had lost a sense of how to dress. Relaxed weekend style or a suit and tie? One day he had thrown on some sweatpants, and his older daughter wasn't pleased when he picked her up at school. "Aren't you working, Dad?" asked Hortense. "Are you still on vacation? I like it when you're all handsome in an elegant jacket, a nice shirt and tie. Don't ever pick me up from school in sweats again, okay?" Seeing Antoine's face fall, she softened her tone. "I'm saying this for your own good, so you'll always be the world's most handsome dad." Hortense was right. People looked at him differently when he was well-dressed. The game of chess over, Antoine watered the plants along the edge of the balcony, picked off dead leaves, pruned the older branches, spritzed the new buds with water, turned the soil with a spoon, and added fertilizer. He was quite concerned about the white camellia. He spoke to it, took extra time caring for it, lovingly wiping each leaf. It had been the same thing every morning for the past year. On this particular morning, however, he'd fallen behind schedule. The chess game had been unusually tough, and he had to be careful not to lose track of time.
"Watch it, Tonio. Don't let yourself go," he said aloud. "Get your act together."
He'd gotten used to talking to himself, and he frowned at the self-admonition. He decided to let the plants go for the day. He passed the kitchen where Josephine was peeling potatoes. Seeing her from behind, he again noted that she was putting on weight. When they first moved to this suburban apartment building just outside Paris, she was tall and slim. Their daughters were so little, barely reached the edge of the sink. Those were the days. He would lift up her sweater, put his hands on her breasts, and whisper things in her ear until she gave in. Joe would bend down over the bed, smoothing the bedspread all the while so it wouldn't get rumpled. Sundays, she would cook. Pots would be steaming on the stove, dishcloths drying on the oven door handle. Chocolate for a mousse would be melting in a double boiler. The kids shelled nuts or gave themselves mustaches with chocolate-covered fingers, then licked them off with the tips of their tongues. Tenderly, Antoine and Josephine had watched the girls grow up. Every couple of months, they would measure them, penciling their heights on the wall, which was soon laddered with little lines followed by dates and the girls' names, Hortense and Zoe. Every time Antoine leaned against the kitchen doorframe, he felt overwhelmed by sadness and loss, remembering a time when life had seemed to smile on him. This never happened in the bedroom or the living room, always in the kitchen, which had once held all his joy. A book by the medievalist Georges Duby lay open on the kitchen table. Antoine bent down to read the title, The Knight, the Lady, and the Priest. Josephine had been working in the kitchen. What used to be a hobby was now paying the bills. She was a historian specializing in 12th-century women at the Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique, the famed CNRS. Antoine used to make fun of her work, saying with a laugh,
"My wife is passionate about history, but only the 12th century."
Now the 12th century was putting food on the table. Antoine cleared his throat to attract Josephine's attention. Her hair was piled on top of her head, held in place with a pencil.
"I'm going for a walk," he said.
"Are you coming back for lunch?"
"I don't know. Don't wait for me."
We've just heard The Yellow Eyes of Crocodiles by Catherine Pancol. Why exactly Charley Bordelon's late father left her 800 sprawling acres of sugarcane land in rural Louisiana is a mystery. Recognizing this as a chance to start over, Charley and her 11-year-old daughter Micah say goodbye to Los Angeles. In Queen Sugar by Natalie Basile, Charley arrives just in time for growing season. But no amount of planning can prepare her for a Louisiana that's mired in the past. Cane farming, according to her judgmental, big-hearted grandmother, is always going to be a white man's business. As the sweltering summer unfolds, Charley must balance the overwhelming challenges of her farm with the demands of a homesick daughter, a bitter and troubled brother, and the startling desires of her own heart. Miriam Hyman performs the book.
The only crops she had ever harvested were the Meyer lemons that hung lazily from the trees along her backyard fence. The only soil she ever tended came in bags from the Home Depot. She exhaled heavily. If she were a country girl, she thought, she could scan the horizon and know which of these godforsaken roads led to her fields. But she wasn't a country girl, not even a little. Charley turned to her window and caught a scent of Louisiana on the June breeze. The aroma of red clay, peppery as cayenne, musty as compost, and beneath it, the hint of mildew and Gulf water. She marveled at how different the landscape was from anything she'd known back in California. The stretch of Highway 5 between Los Angeles and San Francisco, with its endless miles of almond and pistachio orchards, vast stretches of orange groves whose blossoms perfume the air on early spring mornings, rolling acres of grape vineyards, tomato and cotton fields, and of course, the uninterrupted miles of reeking cattle lots. And all of it with the spiny silhouette of the Sierra Nevada, like a promise along the horizon. Charley imagined Los Angeles, with its traffic and smog and relentless sprawl, and beyond it, the never-ending coastline and immeasurable Pacific, ridiculously beautiful in the honeyed light of a Southern California afternoon. Now the vast Pacific had been replaced by an ocean of sugarcane. Waist-high stalks and slender emerald green leaves with tilled soil between. Cane as far as her eyes could see. Charley glanced at Miss Honey, dressed in a butter-yellow polyester dress belted high on her waist. Ginger stockings rolled like donuts around her ankles and white orthopedic sandals. She sat in the passenger seat, clutching her white leather purse. Charley wanted to ask if they were getting close, but remembered how, yesterday, Miss Honey scolded her for arriving 3 hours late.
"Well, it's about time. You said noon," Miss Honey had said, standing on the top porch step. "I started to think y'all changed your minds."
How Miss Honey flicked that purple plastic fly swatter as if it were a riding crop and reprimanded her for cutting her hair.
"You used to have long, pretty hair," she'd said. "Good hair. Now you look like a man."
More minutes passed. A weather-beaten farmhouse set back from the road. A cluster of small wooden shacks in the distance that looked strangely familiar. Were they driving in circles?
"I'm sorry, Miss Honey," Charley said, "but are you sure this is the right way?"
"Of course I'm sure," Miss Honey said. "If that man Frazier said your place was off the old Spanish trail, then this is the way. This used to be an Indian road."
Micah, who had been fiddling with an ancient Polaroid camera Miss Honey had given her, reached over the back seat and tapped Miss Honey's shoulder.
"You can't say Indian. It's Native American. Indian is offensive."
"Oh, really?" Miss Honey said, without turning around. "Do you know any Indians?"
"Native Americans," Micah corrected. "Indians live in India."
Miss Honey laughed, though Charley thought it wasn't a laugh of delight or amusement.
"Well, the Native Americans I know like to be called Indians.
Miss Honey said, fingering her purse strap.
Bunch of them live in the woods behind my house. She turned to Charlie. They built a big casino with a Mexican restaurant and a fancy steakhouse over in Sherrington. Lights up the whole sky at night.
Charlie nodded and was about to suggest they go gambling sometime, feed the slots or take their chances at blackjack, when Miss Honey said,
Nothing over there but a pack of jackals, if you ask me. Jackals and sinners.
They drove on. Out in the fields, a gaggle of laborers followed doggedly behind a tractor. Up ahead, the remnants of an old sugar mill, brick smokestacks, rusted corrugated siding, dust-caked windows loomed over the cane.
We've just heard Queen Sugar by Natalie Basile. The name BJ Novak rings a bell, you're probably a fan of The Office. Novak played Ryan Howard in over 150 episodes. Behind the scenes, he wrote, co-produced, and directed dozens of others. Now Novak offers up One More Thing, Stories and Other Stories, which reviewers have called endlessly entertaining, surprisingly sensitive, and startlingly original. Stories include a tale where a boy wins a $100,000 prize in a box of Frosted Flakes, only to discover how claiming the winnings might unravel his family. A woman sets out to seduce motivational speaker Tony Robbins, turning to the famed motivator himself for help. And post-college friends try to figure out how to host an intervention in the era of Facebook. Across a range of subjects and tones, the stories share playful humor, deep heart, sharp eye, inquisitive mind, and the spirit of a writer with a fierce devotion to entertaining the listener. And there's more to enjoy. The book includes performances by Lena Dunham, Jenna Fischer, Mindy Kaling, Julianne Moore, Katy Perry, Emma Thompson, Rainn Wilson, and others.
The office was huge and quiet. Windows looked out over all of Michigan to Grand Rapids and beyond. There were so many windows, or more accurately, so much window, that the room was very bright even with none of the lights on. Little toys were neatly lined up across his windowsill, a tiny basketball, a tiny pistol, a tiny lemon, each of them sitting on top of a bronze label on a plaque. On the walls were about a half dozen framed, colorful drawings, each signed by many children, thanking him for their super and super great experiences on field trips. You have an unusual last name, the man said, and then said all five syllables of it correctly. I said yes, I had never met anyone else with it, and it seemed that no one could ever spell or pronounce it. I was impressed he had gotten it right. He asked me more easy and straightforward questions, who my parents were and what they did, what town I was from, whether I had brothers or sisters. It was a relief, in the midst of such an intimidating situation and environment, to be asked questions I could answer without even trying to think. I kept talking, letting each answer of mine go longer than the last, which led him to even more questions. How's school? Public, private, easy, hard? Sports? Baseball, soccer, Tigers, Red Wings? Video games? Friends, best friends, bullies, girls? What do you want to be when you grow up? How do you get along with your parents? Do they often buy Kellogg's products? Before long, everything tumbled out. How my parents had strict policies against both sugar cereals and name brand cereals, even the healthy ones. How I had felt drawn to the box in the store anyway. How I had, to my embarrassment now, cried when I lost, which I knew I was too old to do. That very weird follow-up contest that my father had set up for me with the dictionary and the expression he made that I didn't know how to describe. How I had gone back to the store by myself after school. The bizarre and nonsensical things my parents had said about why it was somehow against our values to redeem the prize. How strange it had felt to be sure for the first time that my parents were wrong, and how frustrated and confused and angry it had made me. The staircase, Tom, 8020, how the taxi driver didn't want to let me sit in the front seat for some reason. After I said everything, he stared at me for a second and paused. I can't give you the prize. My mind first went to Tom warning me that this was a trap. Regulations prohibit families of Kellogg's employees from participating in this contest or claiming a prize, he said. Then he smiled, and there was, the only time I've ever seen this in real life, and a phrase I had never been able to quite understand until now, a glint in this person's eyes. And I'm your father. I'm going to tell you a story, and then you tell me what you want to do. 12 years ago, I was a visiting lecturer at the Stephen M. Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. I was 29 years old at the time. I was the youngest senior vice president in the history of Kellogg's. I had called up the school myself and offered my services as a visiting lecturer for one semester. I explained how it was important to give something back to the community, be a role model, to whom much is given, much is expected, all that. But that wasn't it at all. By the way, if I never see you again and end up teaching nothing else to you, that's the one thing I want you to have learned from me. People, even good, impressive people, always want something simple and unimpressive. Everything good and impressive that they do in their lives is a result of the impressive path they take to get what they want, not a result of wanting an impressive thing. It's what brought me here. It's what brought you here. I was really giving myself one semester, that's only 3 months, to find a wife. Someone genuine and beautiful and interesting, and someone outside the circles in which I lived. This wasn't much time, but I was an overachiever and confident, and I was used to accomplishing major things in very set periods of time.
We've just heard One More Thing by BJ Novak. Readers, I hope this week's selection has offered up some inspiration for the new season. Winter is officially over, thank heavens, and our thoughts turn to renewal. For more inspiring titles, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.